It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 400 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. As always, thanks so much for listening. This week is the return of David Pepose, creator of the wonderful book Spencer and Locke, and the new book called Going to the Chapel. We talk about how this book came to be and what the story's about, including Emily Anderson's wedding day and how that comes to pass, including a gang of robbers with an Elvis theme who come to take something from her on that day. We talk about how the book came to be, about how fans are enjoying this take on the rom-com genre, and what else David has coming for us in the coming months. David's always a great guest, and I thought he was perfect for episode 400, which is a very special one. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. It's always great to talk with David Pepose, the writer of Spencer and Locke, which I truly loved, and has a new book in September called Going to the Chapel. How you doing, David?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me again.
It's good to talk with you again. I have to say, before we move into Going to the Chapel, I've got to talk about Spencer and Locke because that fourth issue blew me away.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's been a long time coming. I've been kind of biting my tongue for about a better part of 2 years. We've always known that this was the plan, and yeah, it's all been building to this.
Okay, because I do not want in any way to spoil it, because that if you're a Calvin Hobbes fan in particular, when you get to that fourth issue of the Spencer and Locke 2, it just goes someplace I never dreamed would ever happen, but it makes perfect sense. That's the good thing about it.
Thank you. I've been really excited about that issue for a long time. It's probably my favorite one that I've written out of the entire series, and I felt like it was an ending to this arc that felt very true to everyone involved. And yeah, there's plans. That's all I'll say. We've got plans.
So it sounds like Spencer and Locke 3 is going to happen then.
You know, I can't confirm or deny, okay. Stay tuned. I'm hoping we'll have some very cool news to share about all things Spencer and Locke related very soon.
I don't know what you're going to do now. This is the thing. You have changed the dynamic of what's going on with Spencer and Locke, and I am puzzled as to how this is going to proceed.
You know, all I can say is if we did a third one, there would be a plan in place.
Okay.
And let's just say all the way back before I even approached my artist for the book, George Santiago Jr., I had an idea for at least three arcs, and it was always a matter of, is the demand there? Do people like it? And, you know, well, maybe I've already said too much.
Okay, like I said, it floored me. When I read it, I was so stunned. And so, I just, you know, and that doesn't happen to me very often because, you know, I've read comics for a long time. So to see something that just absolutely blows me away and makes smoke pour out of my ears is just something I treasure. So,
well, I appreciate it. It's tough without spoiling it, but I want, you know, we never envisioned this to be an ongoing series. You know, there's always an expiration date in mind, and there's always a plan in play because of that. And the advantage of being able to do kind of these shorter arcs is that we're able to make every issue count, and we're able to sort of give consequences and sort of lasting changes to the status quo that you couldn't get away with if this was a monthly book, you know. And I sort of look at Spencer and Locke almost, you know, in certain ways, I write it almost like a film where I want each arc to kind of stand alone as its own storyline, but potentially build on for more things to come. So, yeah, there's a plan in play, and Yes, all I can say is I think fans of the book, hang on. That's
okay.
All.
Okay. Because to me, it's just this amazing story that I did not see that coming. Let's just say that. And I, like I said, I've read comics for decades. And so for me, to be surprised is always something I treasure. Because,
thank you. That just means a lot. That was absolutely the goal. And boy, as somebody who has known that trajectory for a long time, boy, has it been tough not talking about it. And so the fact that people got to read that fourth issue and finally got to see what I had planned all along, that was such a great feeling.
See, the last time you and I talked about this was that you were saying that it was something. Oh gosh, it was that you had given it to some people and they had said it was your best work ever. And yeah. I probably have to agree with that. That was really amazing. Like I said, when something floors me, I just cherish it because it's just something really special. And boy, I do not want to spoil it because I want people to read it and get that same impact that I got.
After we're done recording, you and I will talk some more about it.
Okay.
I definitely want to hear your unvarnished thoughts.
Okay. Well, then we get on to going to the chapel.
Yeah.
I've been doing a little research, and you have gotten around as far as the promotion for this has gone. I went and came across like 9-10 sites that were talking about your stuff was, and I didn't even get to start looking at a podcast. So you've been giving this book quite a nice amount of attention.
Yeah. Well, you know, going to the chapel, I find it to be an interesting little bit of counter programming for the direct market. And so I want to give this book as much love as humanly possible because, you know, it's definitely a counterintuitive premise. Going to the chapel is the story of Emily Anderson, who is a bride dealing with a serious case of cold feet. But before she can say anything, her wedding is taken over by a gang of Elvis-themed bank robbers. So what should have become the happiest day of her life winds up becoming the ultimate hostage situation. Mm-hmm. And Emily's going to have to play both sides against the middle to not only get everyone out in one piece, but to figure out exactly what her happily ever after looks like.
It's so interesting because, you know, you use that quote on the cover, mm-hmm. Love is the ultimate hostage situation.
Yeah.
Which is something because, you know, I suppose you'll explore what that actually means as we go along.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's one of those things that, yeah, especially I'm sure a lot of people have been to family events that might feel a little bit like a hostage situation. And I kind of wanted to take that metaphor and just literalize it a little bit. I was looking at movies like Dog Day Afternoon, or one of my favorite comedies is Death at a Funeral. It's a super overlooked movie, but it's basically the story about the world's worst funeral or the world's worst bank robbery, and seeing kind of what happens when these carefully laid plans just spiral out of control, and seeing what happens to all these people when they're kind of locked in close proximity to one another for extended periods of time, and seeing how that level of just genuine discomfort starts revealing very weird truths about people. Mm-hmm. I find that super funny. And so being able to kind of wed, no pun intended, that kind of interpersonal dysfunctional family comedy with kind of a Die Hard style action romp, it's kind of like the best of both worlds.
Now, the last time you and I talked, you were saying that rom-coms were something that a lot of people don't appreciate as much as they might.
Absolutely.
And that you're going to the chapel is about that kind of thing. Yeah, and I read an interview you talked about, you mentioned Die Hard. It's Die Hard meets Arrested Development at a wedding.
Yeah. You know, or if you're a fan of Wedding Crashers, you know, that's another big one. Or, you know, even if you like traditional rom-coms like My Best Friend's Wedding or Bridget Jones's Diary, it's a little something for everyone. I feel like and I think we talked about this last time, but I think romantic comedies get a bad rap. I think a lot of people have a preconceived notion of who's allowed to like them. And so, you know, guys in particular, I don't like rom-coms. Those are for women. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of women out there who say, well, I'm not basic, so I don't like romantic comedies. And I think both of those is a very narrow view on pop culture. I think, you know, a lot of my favorite movies, things like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, About Time, 500 Days of Summer, they're all twists on the romantic comedy genre. It's all got the same foundation. And so I think for people who enjoyed my work on Spencer and Locke, being able to see the kind of twist that I was able to take on crime, they should follow Going to the Chapel, because this is going to be my twist on romance. You know, there, I think it's just as flexible of a genre as crime, as sci-fi, as superheroes. And I think I wanted to make something that I would consider the ultimate date night comic. And I feel like this is it. I feel like this is a comic that you can read by yourself. This is a comic you can read with a significant other or a spouse or someone you just started dating. You know, it's being able to have your wedding cake and eat it too.
Now, something I read in the interviews that we didn't talk about was the fact that this story was inspired by a real life event that you went through.
Yes.
Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
So the initial spark of Going to the Chapel, the idea hit me. I was the best man at my oldest friend's wedding. And best man is I guess, a term that I'm going to use very loosely because I was terrible at it. Everything that could go wrong as best man did go wrong, particularly my planning of the bachelor party. Our Airbnb was trashed on arrival. I had rented a backyard sumo set and didn't realize the backyard was at a 45-degree angle. A couple groomsmen bailed at the last second because they didn't want to pay their share. I wound up getting hospitalized 24 hours before the event would start. So I actually didn't even get to go to the bachelor party I planned because I was in the hospital on painkillers. Everything possible that could have gone wrong did go wrong. And I thought to myself at the time, well, at least it didn't happen during the wedding. And then I thought to myself, but what if it did? And that was sort of the kernel of that idea. You know, I thought to myself, what's the worst thing that could happen in this wedding? And at first, my first thought was, what if the father of the bride hired a bunch of leg breakers to persuade the groom to maybe back off? And then I thought, no, it's what if the bride suddenly decides she's not ready for this? That's the worst thing that could happen at this wedding. And at the same time, that's a really human story. That's a real emotional arc, fear of commitment and sort of not knowing. Saying till death do you part, that's a big promise. And, you know, one that, you know, people shouldn't take lightly. And so – and the idea of having a woman as the protagonist with this theme was particularly important just because I feel like, you know, people joke, they say, oh, fear of commitment. You know, of course, that's a guy thing. You know, you have the wedding toppers of a bride dragging the groom to the altar. But I think women have so much more at risk when they decide to commit to somebody for the rest of their lives. So I thought that that crisis of faith, that crisis of commitment, that's something you can tell a really interesting story about, and that's a real emotional journey that I think a lot of people can relate to.
Well, you know, I'm sure people are constantly telling you wedding stories now because, you know, I'll tell you one real quickly. The pastor of my church, his son was being married. And so we were, a whole bunch of us from the church went to it. It was down around Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I went there. And the interesting thing that happened was that he was – nervous about the whole business. He went pale as a ghost. I mean, I looked up at him in the congregation, looked up and he was like a sheet. And I thought, oh my gosh, he's going to pass out up there. But luckily he didn't. He got through it. But afterwards we said, oh my gosh, man, you look terrible up there. What happened to you? So I was nervous. I was really, really nervous. I thought for sure I'd forget something. I said, nah. So it was just hilarious to look up and see him so pale. And so, you know, uncertain that he could actually get through the wedding service. That was a fun thing to watch.
I can say a previous wedding that I was a groomsman at. Actually, it was my girlfriend and I. It was our first trip together. I got invited to this wedding. I had been kind of pulled in as a groomsman at the comparatively the last minute, and I was stricken with E. coli the previous week. Hadn't been diagnosed yet. I was working at CBS at the time, and it was during the CBS upfronts. So it was my busiest work week of the year. I am like dying, and then the next day I have to fly from New York to Chicago to Indianapolis to go to this wedding, and suddenly our connecting flight in Chicago gets canceled. So I wind up driving from Chicago to Indianapolis with undiagnosed E. coli, with this poor girl who had never traveled with me before. And so I distinctly remember at one point I excused myself to go vomit. And I was there for quite a while, and I think she didn't hear me when I said I needed to go vomit. So she was, are you mad at me? Are you upset that we're traveling? I was like, no, I'm just dying. Weddings and I, oftentimes I'm sort of like the bad luck charm for these things. So I'm glad that I was able to kind of channel that into something, if not productive, at least funny.
Well, it's funny because I'll tell one more wedding story that I was in. I was in this guy I went to college with. He was going to be a pastor. I somehow always end up with pastors in their weddings and stuff. And he had the bride had 10 bridesmaids. And he had 10 groomsmen. I was one of the 10. And he had us, we walked up. It took forever for us to walk to the front because we each came up individually. I don't know what that accomplished. But, you know, when we got there, we were supposed to stand there with our right hand in a fist behind our backs.
Okay.
Kind of military looking. And, some of us didn't quite make it all that way. And, of course, again, the nervous one is not the bride in the weddings I end up at. It's always the groom who's very nervous, and he was so scared. He just stood up there, and you could see him shake, and I was like, oh, no. I thought, he's not going to pass out on us, is he? Oh, no, not that. But it actually got through okay. And, you know, they had an agreement between the two of them that when she was pregnant, she would give him Fritos, a bag of Fritos, and that was the sign that she was pregnant. And a couple months later, it came along, and he walked in the door, and there was a bag of Fritos waiting for him.
Oh, wow.
So that was kind of fun about that. It was hilarious to think. These things are all, because they're so serious, and it's just like you were talking about a funeral. Funerals can, the worst things can happen at funerals because we're trying to be real formal.
Yeah.
I had my dad's funeral. I'll tell one last story and that'll be it. Yeah. My dad had passed, and his sister was there, but she had made a habit of fainting at funerals she went to.
Oh,
no. And we had and of course, we knew better. It was not she was just looking for attention. And so what we did was, I got on one side of her, she's walking out, and my sister got on the other side. And sure enough, she started to head for the floor, and each of us grabbed a hold of her and propped her up and took her to a seat. She was so angry. She was so mad because we didn't let her hit the ground. And we said, you know what? You're not going to do it at our dad's funeral. You can do it any place else you want to do, but not here.
Yeah. I think you hit it on the head that it's, you know, so many of these events, they are by nature very formal and very serious. And I think when you're doing it for sort of a certain preconceived amount of time, usually people can kind of keep it together for long enough that they can be normal human beings until the event is over. With going to the chapel, because you're locked in one location with your entire extended dysfunctional family for 12 hours, that's when the weird stuff starts happening. That's when people start getting real, and you start the masks start to slip a little bit. And in certain ways, people get like super weird and they get super exaggerated with their normal traits. But oftentimes, that's just them being real. Like you start learning things about your friends and family that maybe you didn't want to know. but at the same time, that's really what these events are supposed to be about. Is that you're supposed to kind of come out of this closer and more intimate, and sort of rekindling those bonds of whether it's matrimony or love or friendship or family. You're supposed to come out of these events kind of closer together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the fun twist on this book is, it takes an actual hostage situation to get these people talking to each other.
Now, I have to ask you, of course, and I don't remember I usually don't get into people's personal lives, but have you been married? Have you gone through your own wedding ceremony?
I haven't, you know, and I think it's because I consider that sort of the biggest challenge of my life. And all I'll say is you know, there have been life events that have sort of kept me, you know, off the altar over the years. But, you know, it's something I am really looking forward to doing at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Well, E. coli will do that to you.
E. coli will do that. and, yeah, that'll put you off weddings for a while. But, you know, I always say we'll always have Indianapolis.
Wow. Now, one of the things you do in the book that I really enjoy, because we know the title obviously is taken from a song.
Sure.
I think it's a 50s, if I'm not mistaken, a 50s song. And the thing you do at the very beginning of the book is you actually take the words to the first verse and run it in the comic, which I like. Because a lot of people just allude to the song, but then they never actually talk about the words and stuff. But I think the words really fit really well. And I thought that was a great idea the way you did that.
Thank you. You know, I the thing is, I actually had to pay to get the rights to use those.
Oh, really?
Words. Yeah. I'm not a fan of getting sued, so I went to the proper channels. But I thought, you know, starting our first issue with the actual song of going to the chapel, you know, it's comics, you know, by nature, they're a silent medium. And, you know, it requires you reading the words and sort of vocalizing them in your head for, you know, that's why when you read something, all the characters, you know, sound right because it's your reading of it. Mm-hmm. But a song like going to like Chapel of Love, it's universal. Everybody has heard it. It's cultural osmosis. And so starting our book with kind of this visual montage of Emily kind of, you know, bristling as she's about to go down the aisle, and the Bad Elvis Gang as they suit up and get ready to raid the chapel, it felt like kind of a cool, catchy way to get people interested in the book. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, it was also a way of trying to avoid using certain crutches that I was afraid of developing as a storyteller. Mm-hmm. Spencer and Locke, for people who've read it, you know, it's a fairly wordy book. You know, we have this sort of, you know, cigarette dragging noir narration. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to strip down Chapel in that regard as much as humanly possible. I wanted to see how much I could say with as little as possible, just to see kind of how it felt, you know, just to kind of flex my muscles a little bit. And, you know, because ultimately I think in comics, less is more. Mm-hmm. And so being able to sort of build up that mood and that tension with a song that everybody knows and kind of be able to hijack people's, you know, internal monologue a little bit, just for a few pages that were all on the same page. That's kind of a cool effect, and it felt like a really cool way to start a book. And I know that that's what got my artist in the book, Gavin Guidry. Those pages are what really got him interested in the pitch. Because, yeah, you know, I got my start as a newspaper reporter, and if you don't get people hooked real quick with those opening pages, you're never going to win them at all. So, yeah, it was a fun little experiment.
Mm-hmm. Now, I like the character. I always have to ask, is the main character based on somebody you know, or is she completely a product of your imagination? How did she come to be?
Huh, you know, that's a good question. I mean, you know, I think Emily, Tom, and Jesse, who are kind of our three main leads of the book, you know, it's a little bit of an amalgamation. You know, some of it's drawn from my own personal experience. Some of it is drawn from people that I know. You know, certain people, you know, are based on friends or family or relatives. I consider Emily to be, you know, sort of my neurotic side, sort of my tendency to, you know, sort of overanalyze and overthink and second guess things. But on the other hand, that's what makes Emily so smart and kind of what makes her the linchpin of this whole story is she's the person who can see all the angles. You know, she's so hyper-focused on this wedding that she winds up being sort of the one who might be able to get everyone out in one piece just because she can see the angles that everyone else can't. Jesse, on the other hand, her groom-to-be, her fiancé, he's just a genuinely sweet guy. I consider a lot of sort of my sense of affection and trying to do right by the people I love in my life. That's all Jesse. And he's mixed with a little bit of Sterling K. Brown from This Is Us, the actor who plays Chidi in The Good Place. I always felt like, if we got an Eleanor Chidi and Jason Mendoza reunion, it could certainly be on Going to the Chapel. Mm-hmm. Tom is me when I'm at my most confident, when I'm feeling like a real grade A stud. He's a little cheesy, but he's very suave, but he's got his heart in the right place. I hesitate, Tom, there's layers to Tom as the leader of the Bad Elvis gang. And all I'll say is looks can be deceiving with him in particular. And it's going to be his back and forth with Emily that's really going to drive our book, because Emily's going to find that sort of the line between hostage and bank robber is really going to blur with all that extended proximity to one another. And so she and Tom in particular, I think they're each going to learn a lot from one another over the course of this smash and grab gone wrong.
How many issues in this one?
This will be a four-issue mini. It's not to say that I don't have, some five- and six-issue things down the road, but whenever possible, if I can strip it down to four, I like to, both for my own sanity as sort of writer and ringleader for the production team. But also, I don't want to keep readers on the hook any longer than I have to. Mm-hmm. Whereas my series at Grand Theft Astro is a little bit longer, it's because that's sort of a Russian nesting doll of a high concept. Mm-hmm. Going to the Chapel, though, because it's set in our world, because it's set with our sort of, in our society, with our laws of physics, you don't have to explain things like, time travel or space travel. Mm-hmm. People know exactly what this world is from page one. And so that makes it a lot easier to sort of have this as a very streamlined, lean story.
Well, the other supporting characters are great fun, too. The father, at one point, is yelling into the telephone that he needs birds to release when she gets married, which is, a little flamboyant way to do things. Is he based on, like, say, your dad or somebody else?
I'll say, there are a lot of members of the Anderson clan are certainly inspired by true events and people. I'd actually say Arthur Anderson, Emily's father, actually has a lot more in common with my mom. My mom is a real pistol. Heaven help you if you get in her way or disappoint her in any way. I'll say that Grandma Harriet in this book is certainly inspired by my own grandma, Grandma Helen. I think if Grandma Helen fought in Nam, she would certainly be Grandma Harriet. There's I will say, actually, out of all the characters in this book, BJ, the best man, that's me skewering myself as much as humanly possible. I felt like I deserved it, given my poor showing as best man at my friend's wedding. I felt that I would kind of take the piss out of myself a little bit, just having a best man who thinks he's way funnier than he is, thinks he's way more charming than he is, really is kind of a putz. He's a fun one. But yeah, for me, it's very much sort of this patchwork thing where, like, there are people I know, there's things that I've experienced and things that I've felt. There are pop culture, icons that I tend to look at, and particularly trying to find, what kind of actors I kind of can envision their voice as. And it's sort of, I throw all that in a blender, and that's sort of how I get all these characters out. And by doing a story that's set at a wedding, it really, it helped, it structured itself because weddings are so archetypical. In terms of, you've got the father of the bride, the mother of the bride, you've got, the best man, the maid of honor, the flower girl, all these things kind of, they're expected at a wedding. And so you sort of just kind of go through that line and you say, okay, well, what's the world's worst version of this? these characters, they came maybe perhaps frighteningly natural to me. So clearly, when it comes to dysfunctional families, I guess I'm writing what I know.
Well, Grandma Harriet, I got a kick out of. She was, she says, I was reading other people's interviews, and she seems to be the one people glom onto.
I'm really glad people say that, because Grandma Harriet has a big role in this series. She's kind of, you know, everybody underestimates the old lady, and that's their mistake. That is a huge mistake. You know, that's – I mean, but in general, that's sort of my favorite part about this whole book, is it's all about these best laid plans that get completely wiped out by these super weird people. We talked a little bit about Arrested Development, and this is – imagine if the Bluth family was caught in a bank robbery. How badly would they mess that whole thing up? Yes, this is – you're going to find out in going to the chapel. You know, it's what should be this very kind of, you know, life or death situation. Well, when you have a bunch of rich, white, out-of-touch old people, they're not going to see it that way. And they're just going to say, you know, like, they're going to just start, like, criticizing the bank robbers for, like, how bad they're doing. Or they're gonna find their own unique ways of rebelling in the most irritating way possible. But it's kind of I give the bank robbers a lot of credit that they just didn't turn it into a homicide immediately. They're going to find that what they would consider a very professional operation is going to turn very weird very, very fast on all sides involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other character I got to talk about was the sheriff.
Yeah, Walt.
Funny stuff, because, you know, the one thing, and I don't want to spoil any stuff, but there's a background thing that got my attention. The sheriff is sitting one point reading a newspaper, and there's a thing behind him, and it says Rockford Country, and it's called the Rockford Gazette.
Yeah.
Is that an allusion to the Rockford Files?
Gosh. Yeah, that was our little nod to that. Well, what's funny is it was inspired in part by a typo. I originally had written it in the script as Rockland, because I was thinking, you know, Bad Elvis Gang, Rockland, it's kind of a funny pun. Mm-hmm. And then as it was drawn in as Rockford. And I was like, you know what? That's funny. I'll take that. you know, I think that's a very funny, like, weird kind of like in-joke that Gavin and I threw in there. But yeah, Walt is fun. I liken him a lot to Jeff Bridges' character in Hell or High Water. He's the kind of, like, you know, a good old boy cop who, you know, they tend to, you know, this guy might tend to shoot first and ask questions never. he's the external pressure on this whole situation. I mean, you know, if Emily had her way, she'd spend, you know, the next 12 weeks figuring out, you know, well, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? Walt is the ticking clock. Walt, you know, if he had his way, he'd have SWAT swarm the chapel immediately. And, you know, as we'll see as the story progresses, there's going to be some complications thrown at Walt that's going to kind of keep him from bringing the hammer down immediately. But he's a smart guy. He's kind of like a dog with a bone. You know, he will keep digging and he will keep going after things. He's a simple man in that he is a very sort of seek and destroy kind of character. But he's not a stupid man. And so, you know, having to stay one step ahead of Walt, that's going to put a target at everybody's backs. And, you know, Walt could very well kind of screw everything up for the hostages. But, you know, he could screw everything up for Emily, too. And so, you know, she's going to have to really be – she's going to have to thread a serious needle to sort of get out in one piece.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the elements in the story, of course, that would probably brings the robbery to happen, is the fact that she's supposed to be wearing a very expensive piece of jewelry, shall we say. And that plays into the whole thing, which is kind of interesting, because even in the newspaper that Walt is reading, they talk about it.
Yeah. So Emily has Emily's father is a very rich man, and he has arranged for them to borrow a $250 million necklace called the Heart of Dresden. And so, you know, Emily, it's a little showy for her, but, you know, her dad has a very specific aesthetic that he's trying to pull off for this wedding. So, and that's sort of the MacGuffin of this book is the Bad Elvises say, hey, there's a $250 million necklace. And let me tell you something. A chapel is a lot less secure than a bank. This would be much easier for us, right? Wrong. They're going to find out they should have stuck to robbing banks. But, you know, the Heart of Dresden, you know, it's going to be an important part of the book. in the fact that that's sort of the fuse that sets this whole thing off.
So you mentioned one thing, and I got to ask about it. Is that I'm not exactly sure where this takes place in a town, but the interesting thing about the chapel is it's kind of in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it's, you know, sort of this very kind of, you know, dusty, you know, southwestern kind of town. You know, Gavin and I, we talked a lot about Vegas. We talked a lot about, you know, California deserts. We also talked a little bit about Memphis, Tennessee, which, you know, being in the opposite direction. But we wanted to sort of have that kind of dry, dusty, western kind of aesthetic. We talked a lot about Breaking Bad. We talked a lot about Hell or High Water. We also talked a lot about Baby Driver, which goes to show how long these books take to put together sometimes, is the film Baby Driver had just come out when Gavin and I were first talking about this book. So having that kind of, you know, high noon kind of aesthetic going on, you know, it adds a nice flavor, I think, to this wedding book. And I think it gives it this sort of sense of tone and this sense of pressure that doing it in the suburbs or doing it even in the big city like Dog Day Afternoon, I don't think it would necessarily replicate. This just felt like a very down south, you know, southwest especially kind of story to me. And that I think kind of lent itself really well to both Gavin and our colorist Liz Kramer's individual styles.
Well, the interesting thing to me too is that you know, if it was in the middle of a city, it'd be a lot more complicated than it might be here. So without buildings around the church and stuff like that, what you've got is everybody is largely at this point in the church.
Yeah.
And so when it's not a lot to guess that there's going to be a police presence coming around. They can actually surround the building, and now it's changed everything that's happening. And you were talking about they have to actually talk to each other.
Yeah, I mean, and that was kind of the fun thing about sort of plotting out this book for me is one of the reasons I wanted to tackle a book like Going to the Chapel is I wrote this after the first arc of Spencer and Locke, which again goes to show you how long it takes for these books to get put together. Is that, you know, I wound up writing Spencer and Locke 2 and producing Spencer and Locke 2 faster than it took for Going to the Chapel to finally sort of get picked up and to be drawn and the like. But with the first Spencer and Locke, it's a very stripped down cast. You know, that's a very kind of tight, intimate cast. And, you know, that might be my one regret for that book is that based on the subject matter and based on sort of the small number of cast members in it, I wrote myself into a little bit of a corner as far as diversity and representation was concerned, you know, because you don't want to play into stereotypes by any means. And so having sort of this dark, you know, just, you know, gritty urban story, if you use representation in the wrong way, you really put out the wrong idea. So while Spencer and Locke 2, I think we did improve upon our levels of representation, you know, and in particular women and people of color, I wanted to double down on that for my next book. And so Going to the Chapel, we have a cast of 15 people in it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really wanted to make sure that we tackled, you know, as many different people from as many different walks of life as possible. Mm-hmm. And so what was a challenge about that, but I'm really proud of how it turned out, is that's a lot of balls to have in the air, and you have to start kind of planning individual arcs for each of these characters and being able to sort of triage and prioritize who needs the biggest arc here, who can sort of get away with you know, a little bit of a smaller arc, what are these all going to be based on these characters and their individual dysfunctions, and where am I going to put all these characters at any one time in this one particular chapel. And Gavin, you know, he did me a real favor, although he did kind of put my feet to the fire with it as well. Gavin created a fully rendered three-dimensional chapel on SketchUp, which he was able to then reference for every single scene. But in so doing, we had to then choreograph the entire book pretty much from the jump. And so that wound up actually being really helpful in making the chapel its own character, its own sort of very tactile space. You can't cheat if the whole book's in one spot. You have to be able to say the bathroom's here, the rec room's here, you know, the crypt is downstairs. We've got a balcony up top here. You know, the priest's office is right over here. And where are all these characters going to be in a particular issue in a particular time?
I noticed in the background one point there's organ pipes.
Yeah. You know, and it's sort of, these were a lot of conversations that Gavin and I had at the jump, just saying, okay, what kind of church is this? And what kind of elements do we want to have in here? And so actually, I will say the church that I went to for the wedding where I had E. coli, that was actually a big inspiration for me in terms of, you know, plotting out this heist caper, because, you know, it was a fairly big church and that it had several other rooms, but it still had this main atrium that, like, you know, that would sort of be the main place where everybody congregated. And so I, you know, especially, you know, I laugh because, you know, I'm a Jewish kid who grew up in St. Louis. And so being able to really go in so deep in an actual chapel, you know, I think that's very funny to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's something I got to ask about too. Is I was looking at the, and maybe it's just my perception is wrong. Please. Do we see many of Jesse's family in the congregation? No.
You know, we talk about that actually in issue two, but I think that's part of why Jesse takes this so seriously and takes Emily in particular so seriously, is she's really the only family he's got. And I think that's something we wanted to subvert the love triangle a little bit. I think in a lot of movies, and I think this is a reason why a lot of people turn their noses up at rom-coms, is they feel they're predictable. They think that the love triangle is very obvious. You know, there's one person who is complete jerk, and it's usually the person that the heroine starts out with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, her journey has to be to figure out this guy's a jerk and dump his ass before going off with this new guy who is really the best fit for her. That's too easy for me. I kind of wanted to give Emily some options, kind of in the Bridget Jones kind of vein, where, you know, she's got options in this book. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want Jesse to be a jerk. In fact, he's kind of the hero in a lot of ways. You know, he's a guy who, yeah, he's kind of awkward, and maybe he's not, like, you know, the exciting, sexy choice, but he's the guy who steps up when you need him. Mm-hmm. And watching Jesse step up, you know, but also, you know, his flaw is, as well-meaning as he is, he's clearly not very good at listening. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not picking up on the cues that his bride-to-be is radiating at this point. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Jesse, he's very single-minded about this, and I think it's because he doesn't have any family of his own. You know, he's just got BJ, the best man, and he's going to have to kind of get out from under this tunnel vision and really kind of start seeing things from a perspective other than his own.
No, I got to say something at this point that some people are probably not going to like, but my experience has been women tend not to like the nice guy.
Yeah.
They tend to go for the bad boys.
Well, and I think, you know, in particular in this series, it's sort of Emily, we're going to explore Emily's past a little bit. It's not just her waking up one day and being like, oh, what am I doing? You know, she has reasons for sort of having a little bit of hesitance towards all this. You know, she's got some issues in her past that are, I think, a little unresolved. And that's something she's going to have to kind of come to terms with over the course of this hostage situation, regardless of what direction she goes in. In order to have any sort of future, she's going to have to face her past. Mm-hmm. And so I think in particular, it's sort of, it hits on those buttons that you say, but, you know, so much of this is also about, do I want to escape? Do I want to go on the run, you know, in terms of this, how this wedding is concerned, or is this going to be me blowing up the best thing in my life? Sort of a big question that Emily is going to be grappling with. And that's part of her character arc. You know, as she's trying to save the day, she's trying to figure out, you know, am I going to save my marriage? And I think that's that gives her a little bit of grit and a little bit of inner conflict that I think is kind of fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's such an interesting thing to me that you're doing these kinds of things with the character. The reason I have tended to avoid rom-coms, and you sort of touched on it a little bit, was because it's a 50-50 shot. Will they, won't they?
Well, they won't.
Oh, they're not going to in this book?
Well, you know, I'm not going to spoil anything.
Okay.
You know, it's, but I think it's wherever Emily winds up, it's going to be a journey well earned. Okay. And I think that's really the ultimate point I wanted to make about this book, beyond sort of trying to evangelize for rom-coms and trying to show why there is a market for this in the direct market. But I think so often pop culture sees love and romance and marriage as the end destination, and it's not. It is an ongoing journey. It is an ongoing evolution, and making sure that whatever Emily decides, it's something deliberate and not out of fear. That's sort of her big character arc, and that's sort of her real triumph, because at the end of the day, it's got to be about choice, and it's got to be about not just doing, you know, doing this because, you know, Emily is sort of already on the tracks, but Emily actively choosing what her future is going to be, and, you know, sort of dispelling those anxieties in one direction or the other. So, you know, all I'll say is, you know, she's got good options to choose from if she makes a choice at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm really happy with how we stuck the landing with it. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's the journey, not the destination.
Mm-hmm. Because what bounced into my head when you were talking about that was that some women tend to think that they have to get married, and they have to have children, and they have to, you know, go the family route. Although I think today it's a lot less so. But is that going to play into some of what she's thinking? Is she meeting up to expectations? Is that what's going on?
I mean, I guess to some degree. I mean, mm-hmm. I do think that Emily wants a future, and I think she does want to settle down, but she wants mm-hmm. to do so in her own terms. Mm-hmm. And I think so much of her anxieties are very much – they're clouding her communication, her ability to communicate. And I think that's sort of a big aspect of this book, is there are a lot of things that Emily wants to say and can't. And so rather than being able to say what she feels – she, you know, winds up sort of throwing herself headlong into, you know, a fairly dangerous hostage situation, because that's safer to her than being able to tell her fiance, "I think I have cold feet." Mm-hmm. But I do think, you know, having sort of that momentum with all of your friends and your family, especially when they're as opinionated as Emily's, and as invested as Emily's. Yeah, there's certainly a lot of pressure and a lot of expectations. Mm-hmm. And over the course of this hostage situation, Emily is going to have to finally face up to what exactly does she feel, and how exactly can she actually tell this to the people she loves most?
See, now I got to ask you another question. Yeah. Do you consider this situation, now granted, let's take the people coming in trying to steal stuff out of it, out of the situation. Do you think that many marriages go down this route, that there's not the communication that needs to happen for everything to be as real as it should be?
You know, I don't know. You know, that's a really good question. And it's I don't know. It's not one that I necessarily feel like I am qualified to speculate on. I mean, okay. You know, it's funny because, like you had said, you know, a lot of women don't feel this obligation to marry, and I feel like, you know, I'm in my early 30s, and I do feel like, you know, a lot of people in my peer group are you know, they're not getting married. You know, I think I can name on one hand the number of friends I have that are actually married. And you know, but I do think that the marriages that people do communicate, and they do have these kind of shared values, I think those are certainly the ones that are more capable of going the distance. I think secrets tend to fester. Mm-hmm. And I think so in certain ways, I guess it's a good thing that Emily is going to have to face all those up front.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask one other thing, too, is that this is a diverse marriage.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting because, you know, there still are people who are going to be unhappy with that.
Sure.
But you're dealing with that kind of head on, the fact that these two, you know, they get along real well, and the race doesn't seem to have much to do with it.
No, you know, and I think, you know, it goes back to, you know, some of what I was talking about with having just diversity and representation. I wanted something that I've talked about in a lot of my books is there a reason not to have any particular characters be of a diverse background? Mm-hmm. You know, with Spencer and Locke, like, you know, I was saying, I didn't want to veer into stereotype or exploitation. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of a very deliberate choice at that point, was having Locke be a white guy. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for going to the chapel, Tom and Jesse in particular, I was like, yeah, like, why wouldn't we? This was before, say, you know, Crazy Rich Asians came out, but having mm-hmm. Tom as a dreamboat Asian love interest in a you know, headlining a story, that's still relatively unheard of. Mm-hmm. And having Jesse be an African-American romantic lead, he gets to sort of lean into his nerdy side. Mm-hmm. These are all things that pop culture still doesn't do very well. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wanted to zig where I saw other people zagging, in part, you know, because I feel like it's kind of my responsibility as a creator. I recognize I've seen myself in the mirror. I'm a white guy. Mm-hmm. But to at least have, you know, my creative team be diverse, to have my characters be as diverse as I can make them without, you know, doing anything problematic or offensive, it feels kind of like my responsibility. It doesn't just make financial sense. It doesn't just make creative sense. It makes moral sense. And I think when you have all three of those things together, the question is, why not? You know, like why wouldn't you do that? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I said this in another interview about having Emily be the lead character, you know, a female-led action story, is, you know, how many action movies I've seen that seem so interchangeable. You've got the same kind of forgettable, square-jawed guy. Mm-hmm. But then you see, you know, movies, you know, with Sarah Connor or Laurie Strode or Ellen Ripley. Like, these are the heroines that are, like, standing the test of time. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's always trying to, how can I shake things up? How can I have these characters be as diverse as possible? Because also, just from a purely selfish perspective, this isn't something that a lot of storytellers have been doing. So, you know, we kind of owe it to everybody to keep shaking things up and to sort of say, oh, we don't have a lot of stories with characters like this. I guess we need to write them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, to be honest, comics are going that way, probably more than a lot of
we're the forward thinkers. We're the R&D, because it is. I was thinking about this earlier today. Is that besides being a novelist, where you're the one man band, mm-hmm. comics are sort of the most streamlined, collaborative form of narrative media. You don't need a studio. You don't need expensive equipment. You just need, you know, a pen, paper, I guess a scanner at this point, and whatever you're writing a script on. And so even print costs are still remarkably lower than what it would take to make a video game, or, you know, even to be, unless you're getting a bunch of friends to do it and you have equipment on your own, to make a short film still costs, a short film costs more than it would take to print a 4-issue miniseries. I think comics in that way, you know, we're a little bit like the Wild West. You know, we're taking chances and trying things that a lot of multimedia, because they put so much money invested into it, they're too conservative to try. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think, you know, I feel really fortunate that I fell into comics. It wasn't, you know, I didn't enjoy comics because I thought it would lead to something multimedia. I just like comics because I love comics. Mm-hmm. But I consider myself really fortunate that I feel like we're kind of the trailblazers of storytelling in a lot of ways. And I think it's because comics, you know, for whatever reason, we haven't sort of put on the airs yet of that sort of self-limit, what stories we can tell. Mm-hmm. So we can kind of get as wild and crazy and esoteric as possible. And we lead the way, and everybody else follows.
See, I have to tell you, this book sings movie to me. It feels like a movie that could be easily made.
You know, I wouldn't say no to it. You know, I feel like this story for me is trying to prove a point. And the point is that I used to say in college, this is me dating myself and also outing myself as a huge nerd, is that I was the president of the Brandeis University Comic Book Club in college. And so that's like head nerd in a school that's already filled. But I, what I used to tell everybody is everybody's got a favorite comic. They just don't know it yet. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's the case with every kind of genre, especially rom-coms. Everyone's got a favorite. They just don't know it yet. And that's why I feel like going to the chapel, it's sort of – in certain ways, it's like putting cheddar cheese on your broccoli. It's sort of putting that cool action veneer over this like very engaging kind of dysfunctional family romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And I say, you know, it's a rom-com for men. It's a rom-com for women. It's a rom-com for people who, you know, non-binary. It's a rom-com for everybody. And I feel like there's something for everybody to enjoy about this book. All you got to do is just give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when is the first issue coming out? It's early September, right?
September 4th. And so you can actually pre-order Going to the Chapel through your local comic shop now. We'll have three covers per issue for all four issues. And so Lisa Sterl is doing our first A cover. The pre-order code is JUL191409. So that's Jewel for July, 1914-09. Mon House, who did variant covers on Spencer and Locke, he will be doing a round of variants for us as well. That code is JUL1914-10. And then Gavin Guidry, our interior artist, he is doing a line of C covers as well. And his code is JUL1914-11. And the thing I want to say is I wanted to make Going to the Chapel's creative team, like I said, as diverse as possible. And, you know, considering this is a female-led action story, I wanted to make sure we had as many women on the team as possible. We have a ton of talented creators on board, including our colorist, Liz Kramer, who I say she's going to be the next Laura Martin. She's fantastic. I'm already talking with her about the next book we're going to work on together. Ariana Maher, who is a terrific letterer, who kind of kept me on the straight and narrow. And then we will have a murderer's row of female cover artists working on this book, starting with Lisa. We just announced actually that MJ Erickson from Thrilling Adventure Hour is doing a San Diego Comic-Con exclusive cover. It's our stained glass variant. It's truly gorgeous. And we'll have some really cool artists that we're going to be announcing doing more covers, starting with the next issue of Previews. I won't give the next artist away, other than to say she's got a marvelous resume building up. Really excited. Every cover is better than every cover is better than the one that came before it. It's just I couldn't be more fortunate to be working with such a collection of talented artists, and I'm just so thankful that we could get these very talented ladies to throw us a cover for these books.
Now, are they going to come out the first week of every month, or are they going to vary a little?
I am not sure, actually, about that. You know, as I learned with Spencer and Locke, sometimes it can be a little bit of a moving target with those dates. Mm-hmm. I look at Diamond and I cross my fingers and I just keep checking every week and praying that it comes out the week that we said it would.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the way to avoid all that is to pre-order it through your comic shop, and when it comes, it'll be waiting for you there, so you don't necessarily have to do that. I would let your comic shop know that you want to get going to the chapel, and then I would go back and get Spencer and Locke while you're at it.
Thank you.
And now the thing I'm interested to, you talked about a space car.
Yeah, Grand Theft Astro. We're hard at work on that. I am about two-thirds finished writing it. You know, a variety of personal things happened that sort of slowed me down a little bit in between just juggling Spencer and Locke 2 and wrapping and going to the chapel. Our poor puppy Holly had melanoma, so we had to take her in for treatments for those for about 2 months. And she is on the mend, so your listeners can rest assured. Holly is very happy and has been growling at me all night because she wants to play. But it has slowed me down just a little bit. But we are in the final lap for Grand Theft Astro in terms of writing it. I'm really stoked with how it's turning out. I'm working with artist Jordi Perez from Queen of Bad Dreams on that book. And yeah, really, really excited with how that's turning out. And then I've got a few other irons in the fire. I've got a fantasy book that I am so excited about. We have a team put together. We have art coming in. It is super fun. If you're a fan of Spencer and Locke, what I did for crime with Spencer and Locke, I'm going to do for fantasy with this book.
Okay. So any idea when that's going to hit?
Not yet. We don't have a home for it at the moment. But that will come soon. If you saw these pages that I'm seeing, there will be a home for this very soon. I'm fully confident in that. And it's sort of – that's the fun part about being an indie guy, especially in comics, is you're not necessarily wedded to any one genre. And I said this in another interview, but the reason why I like doing kind of these thematic mashups like Spencer and Locke, like going to the chapel, is I always write every book like it's the last thing I'm going to write. And so every mashup I get to do, it's me checking off twice as many lines of my bucket list before this all goes down the drain. So yeah, I've got a few pitches on the horizon that I'm really excited about. Suffice to say, barring any sort of license work that falls in my lap, I know what I'm going to be writing for the next 3 or 4 years, which it's a cool feeling.
Are you full-time doing this now? Is that what's happening?
I am. I write full-time. I do freelance editing still. That helps me pay my bills. But yeah, I mean, you know, I am a full writer 365 days a year. And boy, it's the hardest job I've ever done, but boy, is it the most fulfilling.
Well, good for you, boy. Congratulations. Because one thing when I talk to folks and they've got a day job, they always say, I wish I could do this full-time.
Yeah.
I wish I could give up my day job and be able to do this, but I'm glad that you've already made that leap.
Yeah, it's, you know, I had to put my money where my mouth is, and I think people use the startup metaphor a lot when it comes to talking about comics, where every book you're doing is its own startup, and you hope it succeeds, but you know there are certain times where things start off as a loss leader, and you got to sort of build your way back up into the black. And thankfully, Spencer and Locke, our fan base has been super passionate, been super rabid. The fact that our second volume has tracked evenly with our first volume 2 years after the first volume came out, that's pretty astonishing. We were actually just looking at Comic Book Roundup, and we're the top-reviewed indie book over there, which is kind of a crazy honor. And I think it's just it speaks to our fan base, and just sort of the reason we're the little indie that could is because the fans have been so loyal to the book. And so I've asked readers to take a leap of faith with Spencer and Locke. And if they think I stuck the landing with those books, I'm asking them to trust me again for going to the chapel. Mm-hmm. It's while the tone is very similar, it's not quite as bleak or oppressive as Spencer and Locke. If you still like kind of my blend of action and humor, you're going to love this book. And I think it's got a very human core to it that I think people are really – they're going to recognize something in this book. I really believe that.
Now, what about conventions? Because I saw you at MegaCon.
October, I am doing at least New York Comic Con and Baltimore Comic Con. And I am waiting to hear back. There's a possibility that I might be doing LA Comic Con here in my hometown in LA. That is still TBD, however. So, but for sure, you'll see me at New York and Baltimore.
I'm going to see you at some of those.
Yeah.
Because I think I'm going to be at New York.
And have the Spencer and Locke 2 trade paperback collection for all.
Oh, by then? Oh, cool.
I'm at the first week of August. But you can still pre-order it at your local comic shop. It's the code JUN for June, JUN 1913 33. And so you can order that anywhere comics are sold. It is in the Diamond catalog. If it's anything like the first volume of Spencer and Locke, that book has a very long tail. So definitely order it, because I think those two trades are going to look real handsome next to one another.
Oh, very good. Well, I got the first one, so I'm going to get the second one too to make sure I have them to keep in my library, because it's great stuff. Because that number four, I loved the series before that. Now I'm passionate about it after.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and look, I also enjoyed what I got to see this one too. So I'm going to follow that along as well.
Yeah, I'm excited for what people. This one's a roller coaster ride, and I will say our first issue is I'd say it's our quiet issue. Once everybody gets to know the family, that's when things really start going off the rails. And weddings, they have so much imagery inherent to the concept that it's fun kind of seeing how you can turn those into weapons. So no institution is safe in my hands at this point.
As usual, I mean, you know, you were with Spencer and Locke, you were doing comic strips. Yeah, I ruined your childhood.
Now I'm ruining marriage. What else am I going to ruin?
What's coming next? Well, cars are going to be next.
Cars. I'm going to ruin cars next.
Okay. Well, David, you're doing wonderful stuff as always. It's always good to talk with you. And much success. I'm sure this is going to be a big hit just as well. Because wherever I look on the internet, I see stuff about it. Even at Major Spoilers, they had the news release about this up there too. So it's good to see.
I gotta find that. I will make sure that I retweet that. But no, tell everybody at Major Spoilers, thank you again for all you guys' support.
We're glad to do it. And just keep it up. Well, I'm glad you're full time because we need you full time to thank do all this good stuff.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Be sure to be back next week when I'll have another interview with a great comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.
It's over, Joker.
Over? Why, my dear delusional Dark Knight, it hasn't even begun.